pretty straightforward. If it's for a pick bar, is that like a much different process?
It's messier, right? Okay. Because cash flow is replaced with the in-kind value of the in-kind. The process doesn't change, but the way of estimating cash flow is really different.
Okay. So I was trying to modify a simple equation for it the other day. It wasn't necessary.
There might be some optionality there too.
Yeah, it's a company that's probably going bankrupt. So that's fine.
Okay, so let's get started. I hope you've started on your mystery project, or at least looked at the data and started working through. But keep at it. So let's very quickly look at what's coming today. I'm going to finish off the section on relative valuation of pricing. And I hate to use the two words, but they're, in a sense, interchangeable. When you talk about valuing something relative to something else, you're talking about pricing. I want to finish that discussion. I then want to talk about, I'm going to take a detour. I said there were three ways to do valuation: intrinsic valuation, relative valuation, and option-based valuation. I'm going to take a detour that's going to sound like I'm leaving the tracks, where I'm going to talk about what's called asset-based valuation. The core of this is, when we value companies, we tend to focus most of our attention on the income statement. What do you make as earnings? What are your cash flows? In asset-based valuation, you start with the balance sheet. And we'll talk about why you might do it and what the rationale for doing that is, how things might be different if you value things based on the assets. And then today, at some point, we will start on valuing private businesses. Small, large, but privately owned businesses, right, as opposed to public companies. So let's do a preview of some of the issues we're going to run into with private businesses. So let's assume you're looking at two companies that are in the same business, are the same stage in the life cycle, have the same financial practices. One is a privately owned business, the other is a publicly traded company. Without knowing anything else about the companies, they look exactly the same, same business. Which of these two would you expect to have the higher cost of equity, Joseph? And tell me why.
Because there's, in a public company, there's less risk involved with holding equity in that company, because
I think we're mixing two things. There's a liquidity issue, but let's say they're equally liquid or illiquid. Okay. Public companies can be illiquid as well. So let's keep liquidity off, because that's a different issue.
Okay.
Two businesses, they actually have the same total risk. You're right on the answer. I'm trying to figure out why the public company, if they have the same total risk, why don't they have the same cost of equity? When I estimate the cost of equity for a public company, what portion of the risk do I bring in?
Well, aren't you looking at, because you're assuming that the person has a diversified portfolio.
Exactly. With a public company, I make the assumption that investors are diversified, so the only risk they care about is the risk that they cannot diversify away. The private company can have exactly the same total risk, but if the owner has all of his or her wealth tied up in that company, this line between diversifiable and non-diversifiable risk really makes no sense. That owner is exposed to all risk, which means that you can have the same company, the same business, but because you have a privately owned business where the owner is not diversified, their cost of equity is going to be higher. And there are going to be consequences. There are going to be what, and we'll talk about what that will, how that will play out in the valuing of these companies. Now talk about liquidity. It is true that private businesses tend to be less liquid than public companies. And in fact, if you ever worked in private company valuation appraisal, you'll often see a discounted cash flow valuation. And at the end of the discounted cash flow valuation, the analyst or the appraiser will knock off 25% of value. You say, what do you do? Why do you knock that off? And they'll say it's because of illiquidity. And you can see the logic, right? Private business is much more difficult to get out of your investment, therefore I'm going to knock it off. What's always troubled me is it's a constant. You know what I mean by a constant? They always knock off 25%. And I've never understood how you get away with that. Because I agree, illiquidity should be an issue, but it should be different across companies, across time, and across buyers. And in fact, let me give you some choices of companies. You tell me which kind of company to expect illiquidity to be the biggest issue. A profitable cash flow generating company to a long-term buyer, a profitable cash flow generating company to a cash-constrained buyer, a unprofitable negative cash flow company to a long-term buyer, or an unprofitable negative cash flow to a cash-constrained buyer. So I've given you two choices. One is whether you're a positive or a negative cash flow company. The other is who the buyer is. Let's take the easier half of the equation. Why does the buyer matter? Because liquidity is in the eyes of the beholder, right? If I'm an investor who basically has a long time horizon and has no cash constraints, I don't care about liquidity as much as someone who's cash constrained and short term. So first is the illiquidity discount should be larger if you're looking at a cash constrained short term buyer than if you're looking at a non-cash constrained long term buyer. There are very few edges you can get in the investment business. Here's one, if you have it, will make you lots of money over time. I have very few promises I offer in excess returns. If you value liquidity less than everybody else, in other words, you can afford to be illiquid, you can generate excess returns. You know why? Because if other people care about liquidity, you can buy assets from them at a discount, especially during periods of crisis, and you're almost guaranteed a bargain up front because you don't care about liquidity. We don't talk about this very often, but we talked about Berkshire Hathaway, you know, a while back. And we talk about all the things that Warren Buffett has brought to the table, his time horizon, the fact that he took a class from Ben Graham, that he hung out with this person, that he lives in Omaha, etc. You know what his biggest advantage is that we'd almost never talk about is? It's related to liquidity. What's he investing? He's investing premiums he's collecting on the insurance business, right? And the nice thing about premiums in the insurance business is they don't panic. Know what I mean by panic? Market's down 6 months, people don't start dropping dead. Maybe they do, but not in exponent. It's not like there's a huge demand on your capital. So in a sense, he can afford to buy assets from people who care about liquidity during crises at a big discount and say, look, I can live through the next 5 years without liquidity. But it's going to show up in transactions like those. So long-term buyers should care about illiquidity less than cash-constrained buyers. What about this cash flow, profitable money-making versus, why does that matter? It's, but remember, we're focusing just on liquidity. Why, if you are a person who cares about liquidity, do you care about cash flow capacity? Go ahead, Richie. In other words, you care about liquidity because you need cash, right? If you have a big cash flow generating company, you might not even have to liquidate the company to be able to. Let's say the company throws off a third of its value in cash every year. That's like liquidating a third of the company every year without having to liquidate it. Whereas if you have a money losing company, not only are you not getting cash flows, but you actually have to be supplying capital to this company next year, the year after, the year after, which means if you care about liquidity, you're in a deeper hole. What I'm laying the foundation for, and this is my biggest gripe with the way appraisers deal with liquidity, is I agree with you, liquidity matters, but it should vary across companies, should vary across time, and it should vary across buyers. It is one of those things in valuation where no rule of thumb, 25% is going to work across all companies, all buyers, and all time. And in fact, the follow-up to that is, I said, when do you care most about illiquidity? And the answer is pretty obvious. If you're trying to sell something in November of 2008, the liquidity discount was huge. Everybody wanted cash. During crises, the liquidity discounts balloon out, and when times are good, they're going to shrink. So across time, you should see these discounts vary. So that's something we'll come back and talk about. How do you come up with different numbers for different companies or different buyers? Because we need to factor that in.
Deepinder? You
go into it, Barbara, and he says number two, number three. You know, basically, if you want to be completely bald, I think number one, you'll just run it through. It's a lawnmower over your head, right, basically. There's no one number that works because the number that I pick for you should reflect who you are and what. So that's me. It's a customized haircut, right? That's basically my. So the discount should actually vary across companies. Of course, we have to come up with a mechanism for doing that. But it is, should be, you know, we'll come up with a way of differentiating across companies. Finally, you're the owner of a private business. You're looking to exit the business. You've hired me as your broker to find the best possible buyer for your business. And in fact, the answer to this I've kind of given away already from two questions ago. Here are your potential buyers. There's another private owner who's interested in buying your business. So make the business if you want a dental practice or a medical practice if need be. You can sell to another doctor or a dentist. You can sell to a private equity fund. There are private equity funds going around now buying up dental practices or medical practices, creating these ones. So you can sell to a private equity fund. You can sell to a publicly traded company. United Healthcare decides it wants to be in this business, and it's going around. Which of those buyers, without knowing anything else about the identity of the buyers, is likely to be the best buyer for your business? Best being the one who delivers the highest number. You think a PE fund? What do you think?
Private owner.
A private owner you think is going to pay the most? So we're going to kind of cover the spectrum. Anybody want to take the public company? Because then we'll have all three covered.
Yeah.
You want the public company? Okay. So what's your rationale for the public company? Remember I said the answer was kind of given away to questions. What was the question I asked you two questions ago, which is you have two businesses, two companies, one is publicly owned, one is privately owned, a public company versus private owner. And we said the private owner will have the higher cost of equity. You know how that plays out, right? In evaluation, if you have a higher cost of equity, what happens to the value you're willing to pay for something? It's going to go down because you have a higher discount rate. So a private owner looking at your business is going to say, I want to make 20% because I see a lot of risk. So when you try to sell to a private owner, what you're going to get in return is going to be lower for the same set of cash flows than what you would get if you sold to a private equity investor. A private equity investor is obviously a little more diversified than a private owner. But guess what? A public company is even more diversified than a private equity investor. So for the same set of cash flows, you will get more value by selling to a public company than you would to a private equity investor. Never. Never will happen. The only way a private equity investor can have higher value is if you can change the cash flows.
They pay higher values in public companies all the time.
If you can change the cash flows. Right. That's the key. Is if you can come in with, as a private equity investor, and essentially say, look, we're going to fix your dental practice. You don't need a receptionist anymore. Those tools you're using for the teeth, they look too advanced. Let's get rid of them. We can use forceps. Just pull out the teeth. In other words, if you have a way of increasing cash flows, value created by private equity investors is almost never in the denominator. It's almost always in the numerator. And that's, I think, and the numerator can be tax benefits you've discovered, ways of cutting costs, ways of increasing revenues. So that's why private equity investors will often jump in certain kinds of companies and offer more than a public buyer, because they're willing to do things that a public buyer either cannot do, because it'll give them a lot of bad publicity, or aren't willing to do. So it's not a cost of equity issue, it's actually a cash flow. Yes?
Yeah, I mean, earlier in the class you talked about how the capital budgeting, you're looking at the company, looking at their cost of equity in capital budgeting. Right? Like,
no, I said the risk of the project. I'm not changing that. It's still the risk of the project, but basically how much of the risk is diversifiable and non-diversifiable is what we're, so if you're taking a project in the steel business, the beta I'm going to use for both the private business owner and the public company is an unlevered beta. for being in the steel business. But with a private business owner, I now have to scale that beta up to reflect the fact that the owner is not diversified. So I'm not changing the fundamental principle, but this is one of the few cases in valuation where two people can look at the same asset and have different valuations, even though they agree on the cash flows, is because they see different risks. And it's, for those of you who like mom and pop stores, this is incredibly bad news. You see why? Because increasingly, as you look at potential buyers, the best potential buyer is always going to be a public company. So you're going to find this almost inexorable movement of private businesses going public. You see, but I know public companies sometimes go private. You're right, they sometimes go private, but you know what the exit strategy there is, right? Not to keep them private, but to take them back public. So when you see PE deals that take public companies private, it's never to make them private business. In fact, that's your definition of a deal that did not work. Is a private business that stays private 12 years after you took it private, is to take it back public. And it's not fair in some ways, at least for me, because it's not that the private business owner is not more efficient and doesn't work harder. In fact, he probably is more efficient and works harder, but he has a mountain to climb because of the risk that he's exposed to or she's exposed to. So we'll come back and talk about how to adjust the cost of equity. If you remember in corporate finance, we've already laid the foundations for it. But those are all things we're going to have to run into. So let me go back and finish the rest of relative valuation. I left you the PE ratio and the PEG ratio regressions, right? I'm not going to bore you with any more regressions, but here's what I want you to remember from this section. I know those of you for whom statistics is this ancient memory, this part is intimidating. You see, I don't remember how to run regressions. You don't have to run regressions anymore, right? You've got Minitab that runs the regressions for you, but you've got to be able to read regressions. So when you look at these regressions, don't wonder about, how do I get the t-statistic? Somebody will do it for you. But once you get that regression, I want you to be able to read it. So here are my PE ratio regressions, and as I said, I run them for the U.S., and you saw that regression already, Europe, Japan, emerging markets, and global. You see, why are you doing all of these? Let's suppose I'm a global hedge fund. I want to value 41,000 companies. Okay? Plug the numbers into that regression, get the most undervalued, the most overvalued. I've listed the R-squareds, and they vary across regions. But the structure of the regressions looks exactly the same. Price earnings against growth and earnings per share, payout and beta. And you can see that the signs are all consistent. I got lucky. In every market, it looks like higher growth increases PE, higher risk reduces PE, higher payout increases PE. So this is the PE regressions across the markets, start of 2015. I did the same thing with price to book. I ran regressions, and there are four variables in my US regression. Growth, beta, payout, that was in the PE regression as well. But see return on equity in there? It shows up because when I did the algebra on price to book, return on equity is a companion variable, it's in there. And you can see by far it is the most significant variable in explaining return price-to-book ratios across the world. No matter what market you go into, high return equity companies have high price-to-book ratios, low return equity companies have low price-to-book ratios. So same three variables as in PE with ROE throttle. Then I did EV to EBITDA. Again, I looked at the equation that I had, and I looked at tax rates, because remember, EV to EBITDA is a pre-tax number. I looked at the debt ratio to capture, you say, why aren't you using beta anymore? Because now we're looking at an enterprise value multiple. So I've got to look at a measure of risk across the company. And for growth, instead of using growth in earnings per share, I use growth in revenues. Do you see why? With an equity multiple, earnings per share growth makes sense. But if you're looking at an enterprise value multiple, it's got to be something further up the income statement. Growth in operating income, growth in EBITDA, growth in revenues. Growth in EBITDA, it's tough to find on Capital IQ, so I went with growth with revenues, and it's actually a two-year growth rate, but to take what I can get. So the subtle change as I go from an equity multiple to an enterprise value multiple on what variables I throw into the regression. Then I threw EV to sales, and again, the variables should be by now familiar. There's growth, there's margin, because that's a companion variable, and it's by far the most significant variable across markets. The R-squareds are all over the place. Again, reflecting the fact that some multiples work better in some markets than others. So at the start of every year, I had a total of about 30 regressions that I run. Different multiples, different regions. And they stay for the whole year. And the next year I rerun them again because the coefficients do change. Okay? So the end game, though, is to use these in predictions. Yeah.
Can you explain again why the debt ratio is one of the factors that you're using?
What you want is a cost of capital number, right? Basically, low cost. Remember the logic was low cost of capital companies should have higher EV to EBITDA. This might be statistical coincidence, but companies with high debt ratios across the world, holding all its constant, tend to be companies with lower cost of capital. Either because they can have more debt capacity, right? And that's what you're finding. Companies with high debt ratios, you're saying, but debt is risk.
The negative,
isn't it? It did. Or no, it's positive, right? It's on the debt ratio. It's cutting in the wrong direction. They're acting as a measure of risk, I guess, because something else is capturing it.
Okay, but what you were saying previously,
it's debt ratios are my proxy for cost of capital. That's basically what I'm trying to capture.
Yeah.
You know, it cuts both ways here. You're saying, why don't you measure, put in cost of capital? Because then I've had to get betas and cost of equity and cost of debt for every one of 41,000 companies, and I wasn't sure that I wanted to go down that road. But again, what I'm trying to capture is what I had in the original equation. Yeah. Yeah, on EBIT EBITDA.
Is that because of the
distribution? See, the debt capital, debt to capital, like, remember the cost to capital ratio. Is higher debt ratio leading to lower or higher cost? It depends on where you are in the spectrum, right? And if you're looking across 41,000 companies, who knows what debt ratio is capturing? It might be capturing distress, in which case it's a measure of risk. It might be capturing tax benefits, in which case it's a measure of low cost of capital. I've seen that coefficient go positive, negative, depending on the country, depending on the market, depending on time periods. It's tough to read, but it's the only measure I could think of that could capture cost of capital. If I throw in beta, you're going to get, you know, high beta companies not necessarily having high cost of capital because of the way they get there. So I can't think of an easy way to bring in cost of capital without actually measuring cost of capital for every company. Yes, Joseph? Okay. So here's my closing propositions on pricing. When you price something, remember that all you're saying is this stock is cheap or expensive given these other stocks you're comparing it to. If you get a chance, take a look at the valuation of the week from yesterday. I took Lukoil, a company I valued with an intrinsic valuation model a couple of weeks ago, and I priced it. And I priced it against three groups. First, I priced it against other Russian oil companies. There are three others. And it looks like it's fairly priced. It's like 6.35 times earnings, trading at half of book value, 5 times EBITDA, but that's what all those companies trade at. So if I made the judgment against other Russian companies, I'm going to say hold. I compared it against other emerging market oil companies, which is about 21 big integrated oil companies. It starts to look cheap. And then I did global oil companies. It looks even cheaper. You think, which one's the right answer? Pricing, there is no right answer. It's what you're comparing yourself to. So in relative valuation, you're making a judgment relative to what you're comparing things to, which means your buy or sell has to be read in that context. So you can be right about your buy, but if your sector that you're comparing it to is all overpriced, your basic conclusion about putting your money into the stock might not be a good one. Second, you probably already discovered this as you start looking for similar companies out there. Whatever company you're valuing, take any company you want, Amazon. Find 20 companies like Amazon. And you're very quickly going to realize that there are no similar companies, which means you've got to find ways of controlling for the differences. I might have gone a little overboard on statistics, but that's why I'm bringing statistics in, because I've tried storytelling. It doesn't work for me. I need some way of saying higher growth, this is what it means. Higher tax rates, this is what it means. And that's all those regressions are for me, are ways of controlling for differences. So that's, I think, the overall thing to remember. Relative valuation is pricing, not valuation. Nothing good, nothing bad about it. It's just a different way of thinking about attaching a number to an asset.
Statistics question. Like, R-squared, would you say, is like high enough for you to use it?
Here's my response to it. When you use a regression, you get a predicted value, right? So when you get 100% R-squared, your predicted value is perfect. When your R-squared is 90%, you get a predicted value, but there's a range, but it's a fairly small range. When you get a 25% R squared, you get a predicted value. So rather than say this is my cutoff for a good R squared, the way I think about it is If I have a low R squared, then I get a big range around my multiple. It becomes more difficult to conclude then that something is cheap or expensive because it's more likely to stay within the range. So I can live with a 10% R squared and use it. The only problem is with the 10% R squared, your stock has to be much more mispriced before it becomes overvalued or undervalued. And since that's all I care about is whether I'm acting on that decision, I can live with really low R squareds. So let's talk about picking a multiple to use. Yes, Joseph.
So in terms of picking like a proxy for certain values, like you use the debt ratio as a proxy for the cost of capital, and previously you used different metrics to account for risk. But what if you keep trying different multiples or different?
As long as you have a story connecting to a fundamental, all bets are off. So if you say, I'm going to measure risk based on size of the company, in pricing, I can't say you're wrong. If that's the way markets think about risk, if small companies are risky and large companies are safe, I can argue from an intrinsic value standpoint, that's not a good measure of risk. But intrinsic value is not what we're doing. We're doing pricing.
Okay. Hey? You just really have to think from the perspective of the market.
Exactly. Okay. Pricing, that's exactly right. You have to think about what do buyers care about. I give this very absurd example. Right? Real estate is all pricing, right? The way you buy a house, people attach number. What if I told you that people pay higher prices for houses with more chimneys on them? You think that's absurd. But if that's what they're doing, here's what you're going to do. If you're a realtor, you're going to count chimneys. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5 times $100,000, $500,000 for the house. If you're a homeowner, now you start to act on that, which is? You start putting chimneys all over the house. No fireplace, it doesn't matter. Put 2 chimneys there, 6 over there. It's exactly what happens in markets, is people start pricing something, companies start delivering based on what... So people, if companies are being priced in, based on the number of users they have, guess what companies are going to start doing? They're going to go out and acquire more users. That's the nature of pricing. And you got to recognize that as a risk you face when you start to go into the pricing game, is you are running the risk of being caught up in whatever the mood of the moment is, the flavor of the day, and pricing something based on that. So let's talk about picking between multiples. So we've talked about, 9 different multiples, PE, PEG, price to book, EV to sales, EV to EBITDA, EV to invested capital. So if you take your company and you took every multiple and you tried each multiple, you're going to come up with different values for your company using each one, almost guaranteed. So let's say you did that. You get try 8 multiples, you come up with 8 values for your company. You have to buy or sell, right? So you can't have 8 numbers floating around. You've got to decide what to do with those. Let me give you some choices. One is you can take all 8 values, add them up, and divide by 8. And come up with a simple average. That way you don't let any work go to waste. You've got 8 different multiples all embedded in the number. My advice is please don't do that. Because you're going to take good stuff, bad stuff, throw it all in there. If you're going to use all 8 multiples, let me offer you an alternative. Maybe you can come up with a weighted average. Weighted by what? By how precise you think each multiple is. You're saying, how the heck am I going to come up with that? We just talked about R squareds. Let's say you have 8 multiples. You've tried 8 different regressions. One multiple had an R squared of 85% and one multiple had an R squared of 8%. You want to weight the 85% more and the 8% less. So statistically, what you're looking at are the standard errors of your estimates and maybe weighting based on which of your numbers is most precise. You want to weight it more, and which ones are less precise, you want to weight less. It sounds complex, but you've got to figure out some weighting mechanism that takes into account the precision of each of your estimates. I'll give you my preference. I prefer that you pick 1 out of the 8. It means you throw out work that you've done, right? Because you did the other 7, and I want you to throw it out. Pick 1. You're saying, which one? I could give you the cynical answer. Pick the one that best fits your story. We talked about this last session. So if you had to pick between the multiples, pick the one that's most convenient. And I want you to remember that. The next time you see an analyst presenting a valuation and he says, I've used EV to EBITDA, and I use these 11 companies, make yourself a pest. Ask, is that the only multiple you tried? He lied. Say, yeah, it's the only multiple I tried. But he probably tried 7 before he picked EV to EBITDA. Then are those 11 companies the 11 you started with? Again, he lied. And 11 was what I got. The reality is he got 26, he dropped 15. You will learn more about bias by looking at the 15 companies that got thrown out and the 7 multiples he's not showing you. If you let me pick a multiple, and you let me pick the 10, 11 companies I show you, you've conceded the entire game to you. I can show whatever I want. And that's what we do all the time. At road shows, for instance, when an investment banker gets up and says, we use EV to sales and we use these 11 companies. And we let them control the agenda by doing that. I know it sounds like something that ruins the mood of the moment by bringing these up, but I think we need to start shaking up this process by asking that question. So cynically, you can say, pick the multiple that best fits the story, because that's what most people do. If any of your engineers are quant people, this, of course, drives you crazy. You want something more substantial to build it on. Go with the higher R squared then, because if nothing else, you can say, I can explain it best. So that's the advantage of trying 6 multiples, seeing which one has the highest R squared. Or pick the multiple that makes the most sense for the sector in which your company is in. So how would I know? Here's a simple way to figure out which multiple to use. In every sector, managers tend to focus on one or two key variables. Let's take an example. If you're looking at retailing, in every earnings report, what does every retailer report? Same store sales and margins. Big deal, right? Same store sales and margins. If the focus is on same store sales and margins, what multiple do you think best fits that focus on margins? Some revenue multiple, right? Basically, if your focus is on margins, revenue multiples make the most sense. If you look at a financial service company, the focus is on return on equity because you have regulated equity, you have limited equity, you want to get the most bang for the buck. If your focus is on return on equity, guess which multiple goes with that focus? Price to book ratios. If your focus is on growth, it's going to be PE ratios. You tell me what managers in a company focus on, I'll tell you the multiple that goes with it. You're saying this doesn't work in social media. Of course it does. What's the focus there? Acquiring users. The multiple that makes the most sense is value per user. I know it sounds absurd, but pricing is not about what you and I think is right. It's about what people are focused on in pricing companies. In fact, when I got those 550 equity research reports, remember I started this process by describing them? One of the things I did was with each sector, I looked to see what multiple was used most frequently in each sector. So this is not about what's right. This is what analysts tend to use. Cyclical manufacturing, housing, steel, etc. You saw a lot of PE ratios using normalized earnings. With growth firms, you see a lot of PEG ratios. For some reason, people still believe that if you can put growth into the equation, it makes it go away. For young growth firms, which are losing money, you see a lot of revenue multiples for obvious reasons. For infrastructure companies, cable, road building, toll roads, you tend to see a lot of EV to EBITDA. REITs are the only sector where I've seen price to what's called cash flow earnings, where they add back depreciation to the net income. Part of the reason for that is real estate throws off a lot of depreciation. Financial services, you see a lot of price to book ratios. And with retailing, you do see a lot of revenue multiples. It used to be price to sales, but increasingly people are moving to enterprise value to sales. Okay. Jordan, you have a question?
Yeah, for all these firms being valued on eyeballs or users, isn't that the same problem that we encountered in the web tech bubble 1.0?
Yeah. I'll tell you that it's by itself it doesn't bother me, but there are transition moments that the market goes through. Why are we focusing on users right now? Because we really don't know what the revenues will look like. We just have to focus on something. So I can see why markets focus on users. There will be a point in time when the market changes its focus. You know what I mean by changing its focus? It starts asking, what are the revenues? And then they'll be looking at revenue multiples. And then there'll be another point in time further down the road where they say, revenues are nice, but do we want to see some earnings, right? I call these bar mitzvah moments. Right? Because in a sense, you have to grow up. Initially, it's all about users, and it's all fun. I have more users, you have more users, we have more users, let's push up the value. Then you have that bar mitzvah moment, and you report to the market that you have more users, and somebody asks, where are the revenues? He says, you've never asked me that before. Time to grow up. Painful moment, but keep going. Bar mitzvahs are not painful. The earlier moments are painful. So I didn't want to name that moment because it would be really painful, but this is... Basically, that's what's happening is those transition phases, and that's where pricing gets screwed up, right? because you get really good at pricing per user and you think you've got the whole game nailed down, and the game changes. So if you're going to price, you have to price based on what people are doing, but you also have to forecast when those transitions are happening, because unless you adjust, you can do everything that used to work 2 years ago and nothing's working anymore. Yes, sir.
Would that be for individual companies in
that industry? It often is. Entire sectors go through these transitions, because what happens is for a period, a sector gets a pass,
right?
Where people say in this sector it's too difficult. But as that sector starts to age, you often see these transition moments that are not individual companies. And that's what makes it so messy, is it happens across the board. And that's when you get adjustments in prices for the entire sector, because it's almost like people are reorienting value to a new metric. Well, older is just 3 years old as opposed to 1 year old, right?
Like, there's now a greater emphasis on
and often that's what triggers it, is you start to see companies either making money or struggling to make money, and then you say, you know what, we have to start asking more difficult questions about it.
So what you're saying is that they start asking that of some companies,
Exactly. That's exactly it. And in fact, if you get a chance, go back and look at the Twitter. The San Francisco, they had an analyst conference in San Francisco a few months ago where the CFO got up there and he talked in terms that Twitter had never used before, which is about revenues for the next 10 years and growth rates and margins. And that's why I called it Twitter's bar mitzvah moment, because I said, you know what? You're waking up to the fact that this is not just about users, that has to be converted into real numbers. Yes, sir. How forward is forward?
Let me rephrase that. It's a dangerous word.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you start thinking about the various monetization models?
Exactly.
And then what those look like, and from those monetization models, come up with ratios based off of them.
Yeah, okay.
And preempt the market shifting.
You can get ahead of the market shifting, right? And then hope that the market catches up with you. That's why I said how much forward, because if you. At the limit, what you're doing is bringing in intrinsic valuation through another door, right?
Yeah.
Because when you say you're going to ask those questions, you're really starting to flesh out the rest of the Excel spreadsheet. And you're saying, if I took an intrinsic value look at the firm, will it pay off? It depends on how long you're willing to wait, right? You could be doing intrinsic valuations of social media companies and might be 2017 before it happens. And there's no glory that you're going to get from being right in it. People are going to be really pissed off at you for being right. So it's the nature of the process. So the real question I hear is, can I bring an intrinsic value tool and get ahead of the game here? I think you can, but it might be a while before it catches up with you. Okay? One final point about pricing. Have you ever been on Zillow?
Yeah.
Right? And Zillow, basically, when you look at any house, if you get a chance, go and look at Zillow. They'll have the house listing. And below, they'll have the Zillow e-estimate of the price for every house. Have you ever wondered how they come up with that e-estimate? They haven't done it. Zillow has like hundreds of thousands of houses listed. They must have some very busy analysts, right, working through e-estimating it. Okay? Sarve and I were talking about this just before the class. What they have is a regression that they've run of all transaction prices on houses against what? Against all the things that realtors talk about. How many bedrooms do you have? How big a lot size do you have? Whether you're on a dead-end street or in a busy street. So they build this regression, and then you know what they do? They plug in the numbers for every house that's coming up to be listed into the regression. They get a predicted price. That's what the Zillow e-estimate is. It's a regression approach to pricing real estate. And works really well, because in real estate, you don't get the kind of variation you'd get with stocks. There's a guy at Princeton called Orly Ashenfelter, who's a professor there, who's actually built a regression model to price wine. You know how wine is usually priced, is you've got these people who take little snifters of it and act all uppity about the whole thing. You know, I want a wine, you don't know wine, sniff the damn thing. So it smells like this, smells like that. And then after about 16 hours of sniffing and drinking, when they're too drunk to care, they put a number on it. And for this, you got to pay these people incredible amounts of money. So Bordeaux 1956, that's a vintage year. Says who? Says that guy who's drunk, too drunk to know. Okay? So what Orly Ashenfelter did was he actually took the prices that people were paying for wine, and he ran regressions against what year it was and how much rain there was during the year, all the things that these people... And he came up with this really good regression that actually predicted wine prices better than the drunk 16-hour, you know, after a 16-hour binge person out there. If you get a chance, type in Orly Ashenfelter, pricing of wine. It's, what I'm saying is what we're talking about is something you can, maybe you can build a Picasso pricing model. Base a number of noses on the portrait, which side it comes out. It's a process you can generalize to any asset class. We have observed prices and variables you think matter. So you finish a relative valuation, and we've talked about this, so you could probably know the answer. You value the same company using an intrinsic or relative value. Even if you do everything right with both, you're not necessarily going to come up with the same number, right? Why? Because in an intrinsic valuation, you're asking a question, given the fundamentals of the company, what would I pay for the company? In relative valuation, you're asking a question, given how other things are being priced, how much would I pay? Okay. So let's say you've done this for your company, you come up with an intrinsic value or relative value. And again, we've kind of answered this question. I said the one thing you cannot do is average the two. That's the one thing that is a no-no. But if you say, I'm going to go with the intrinsic value, you're basically saying I'm an investor. That's basically Jordan's question. Is if I want to invest in social media companies, can I do a valuation? If you're an investor, that's exactly what you should be doing. But if you're a trader in social media companies, you don't care about the intrinsic value. You care basically about what's the price going to be 2 days from now, 2 hours from now, 2 weeks from now. It's a pricing game. So I don't think of pricing as a lesser skill. It's a different skill. Let me give you one final example of pricing. I might have given you this example already, but I'll send you this link if need be. So I was talking to a hotel appraiser. So it was about 10 years ago. I don't even ask me where I ran into the guy. He'd been valuing hotels and motels for a long time. And I said, no, how do you value hotels? He said, it's very simple. I go in and I buy a Coke, Coca-Cola, not cocaine. No, that'd be illegal. And I take whatever the price of that can of Coca-Cola is, I add 3 zeros to it, and I multiply by the number of rooms in the motel. So think about it. You go to Motel 6. Where do you go for the can of Coke? It's usually down the hall in that little dark space where you kind of feel creeped out, and you go in and you grab it out of the vending machine for a dollar, right? Add 3 zeros, multiply by the number of rooms. You got the value of the motel. You go to the Waldorf Astoria. You know where the can of Coke is? It's in that refrigerator with two locks on it. You open it, they already know you've opened it. It tells you. They move things around, we'll act like you stole it. You take a Coca-Cola out of there, it probably costs you, what, $7.50 right there. $7,500 per room multiplied by the number of rooms. I thought he was joking. But about 2 years later, I read this extended piece from the Cornell School of whatever, the hotel management, on how to value hotels. And here's one technique, the soda can technique. I'm not kidding. I'll send you the link. What? Take a look at it. Take the soda can, add 3 zeros, multiply by the number of rooms. You've got the price of the hotel. It's amazing how much you can carry this pricing to its logical limit, right? You can say it's absurd. But if it works at pricing things, all the more power to you. Right? So let's review. So when you look at a multiple, start off by defining the multiple. Make sure it's consistently defined. Make sure it's estimated the same way for every company. Describe the multiple. Look at that cross-sectional distribution. Remember, it's never going to be symmetric. Don't use the average. Think about the median. Third, analyze the multiple. Do that little algebra trick, right? If it's an equity multiple, go back to a dividend discount model. If it's an enterprise value multiple, go back to a firm valuation model. And only then should you apply the multiple. Define, describe, analyze, apply. So if you're going to use multiples, at least do it well, right? Because my problem with people using multiples is they're incredibly sloppy about the way they do it. And if we can get the sloppiness out, we can do this much better than we do it right now. So now let's talk about assets. Okay. So in intrinsic valuation, you value an asset based on its expected cash flows, adjusted for risk and growth. In relative valuation, you price an asset based on how similar assets are priced. In asset-based valuation, you value an asset from the bottom up by valuing everything it owns and adding them all up. You're saying, why would I ever want to do that? Here are three places where you might have to use asset-based valuation. First is if I'm liquidating a company. Do you see why it's got to be asset-based? Because you're going to sell off the pieces of the company. You need to tell me what asset A, asset B, asset C, asset D, asset D are going to be priced at. You might have to price the assets individually. The second is if you had the singular misfortune of being an accountant and I ask you to do fair value accounting. Because then your job is not just to tell me what the value of the company is. You have to attach values to each of the assets. And whatever you can't attach a value to, you have to call goodwill. So that's basically fair value accounting. It's asset-based valuation. And the third is, as an investor, sometimes you might do asset-based valuation because you think the sum of the parts is greater than the value of the company as it exists today. So I want to go through the process of asset-based valuation because much of what passes for sum of the parts valuation out there is usually back of the envelope pricing. And I'll explain what I mean by that. But we're going to talk about how to do this right. If you have to value a company as a sum of its parts, how do you do it right? So we're going to talk about doing intrinsic valuation of some of the parts and why it can be difficult for some companies. We'll talk about pricing the individual parts and why it's often easier. Or why sometimes you might just use book values of the assets as the sum of the parts. Okay? So let's talk about when this is going to be easiest. You give you a company and say value it in its parts. It's easiest to value companies as the sum of the parts when the assets or businesses are separable. You know what I mean by separable? You have five businesses, they're actually pretty independent of each other. There's no intra-company stuff. It's easy. It's much more difficult when they're connected. If I took Disney, for instance, you know the part of Disney that's going to be easiest to value separately? The theme parks are tough. You know why? Because they're connected to the movies, which are connected to, you know, the broadcasting. But ESPN is probably the one part of Disney which I don't think there's a Frozen premium at ESPN. You don't sit there saying, they didn't mention Frozen during that Rangers preview of the Stanley Cup. I'm not listening now, right? So it's separable. That's what I mean by separable. But the longer it stays within Disney, the more difficult it's going to be to separate it out because who knows how many interconnections you create between the company. It's nice if each part of the business is standalone and delivers cash flows on its own. And finally, it's makes your job a lot easier if each part of the business is other companies which are standalone companies or standalone assets in that business. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a multi-business company and try to do a sum of the parts pricing first and then a sum of the parts valuation. Okay? So with liquidation valuation, as I, you know, it's going to be just whatever, you know, if I was selling each piece, what can I get for it right now? Okay, so you're going to do the best you can, but remember, if it's a liquidation valuation, you might have to take into account that if you're trying to sell different parts of the company in the market today, you might not get a fair value or a fair price because you're trying to sell everything in a hurry. So liquidation valuation, and we'll talk about this, the key number you have to estimate is how much of a discount on the price will I have to take because I have to liquidate everything quickly. In accounting valuation, things get really messy. About 8 or 9 years ago, a panel met in New York. It was the accounting rule writers, and they were writing the fair value accounting rules. And they asked me whether I'd come in and talk to them about what the process should be. Very reluctantly, I made my way into that room. But before I made my way into the room, I said, you know, before I come and talk to you, I'd like to know what your mission is. What are you trying to get people to do? And they pointed me towards FAS 157. I went and took a look at it. It's fairly long. If you get a chance, read it. Because I was trying to see, what exactly are you asking accountants to do? And basically, if you read through FAS 157, what they were suggesting that accountants attach as a number to an asset is the price that they would receive if they sold the asset to a third party today. Those are key words. So they call this fair value accounting. But what exactly do they want you to put on each asset? It's a fair pricing. That, in fact, the first thing I said is, you got the wrong name on what you're doing. It's not fair value accounting, it's fair price accounting. And that's exactly what it is. It's a fair price accounting. And it creates huge problems, because here's what the rule writers did. They didn't change the name. They called it fair value accounting. They asked people to price assets, but they asked them to turn in discounted cash flow models to back up their prices. This is a mission from hell. Because think about it. Let's suppose I'm a company with a social media division. How do I price it? I take the number of users, multiply by 100, I've got the price, right? And then what do I have to do? I have to reverse engineer a discounted cash flow model to deliver that 20 billion or 30 billion or 50 billion. And the only way I can get there is by breaking every rule in the book. I mean, you'd be amazed how many calls I get from accounting firms where teams have been stuck on this because they've priced the assets, they know what number they want to see, but they can't get their discounted cash flow valuations to even get close. So they say, what do I do? I said, take it up with the rule writers. Because I think the problem here is, if you admit it was fair price accounting, then this is what you need as backing. You'd have to give me a comparables, a list of what you priced it on, and that'll be the end of the game. Don't ask for an intrinsic valuation backing if what you're asking people to do is a pricing. So if any of you are in one of these accounting classes where you're talking about fair value, make a pest of yourself. Say, oh, is this really fair value? I don't think it's fair value. It's really fair price. And people might think you're quibbling, but it's central to why this process is always going to give you strange numbers. Yes, sir.
Isn't that the difference between level 2 and level 3? In terms of level 2 is basically comps, and level 3 is some sort of intrinsic, whatever you want to call
it. See, but the problem is it's fair. At every level, this is the overriding test, is will somebody pay that number right now? And guess what? You can make this level 2, level 3, level 4. But if the test is, will somebody pay this right now? It's still a pricing mission.
It's assumed orderly markets are not fires.
That's exactly. But still, it's an orderly market. In a social media company, in an orderly market, I can get $100 per user. Right? So it's not a question of this being an unrealistic price. The question is, why ask people to provide a valuation justification for a pricing mission? Right? So fair value accounting really should be renamed fair price accounting. And therein lies its weakness. One of the reasons people push fair value accounting is because they say by doing this, we're going to stop bubbles. That's part of that big mission is maybe if balance sheets really reflected true value, but the way you've set the mission up, you're never going to stop bubbles. You're just going to show me the bubble just before it bursts, and then after the bubble bursts, you say, oh my God, it burst. That's why fair price accounting didn't work with financial service companies, because that's what they've been using for, what, 30 years? So pre-2008, they said, this is the fair price. 2009, they said, this is the new fair price. It was 50% lower than the old fair price. That doesn't help anybody. So now let's talk about some of the parts valuation. So you're an investor, you're looking at a company and saying, well, what's it worth to me if I break up this company? So I'm going to take a company that's a multi-business company and take you through first, as I said, through a pricing of the parts, and then we'll talk about valuing the individual parts. Company you're probably familiar with, it's United Technologies. Think of it as a GE on a smaller level. I could have done GE, but I didn't want to kind of create the thing of the table itself would go 2 pages. So I said, let's stay with United Technologies. United Technologies is a pretty diverse company. In fact, it's in 5 businesses. It owns Carrier, which is refrigeration systems, Pratt & Whitney, which is a defense company, Otis, which is in elevators, so basically you probably heard about them, UTC Fire and Security, which makes security, you know, stuff to go, you know, if you want to secure your house, etc., Hamilton Sunstrand, which is a manufacturing company, and Sikorsky, which, of course, makes those big helicopters. So 6 different businesses. One of the nice things about doing a sum of the parts valuation in United Technologies is they give me significant detail on all of the parts. You think, isn't that always going to be the case? Not necessarily. U.S. companies have to report segment stuff, but some report more segment stuff than others. Here, no, United Technologies gives me revenues, EBITDA, pre-tax, operating income, CapEx, depreciation, and total assets. There's an amount of accounting game playing, I'm sure, going on in the background. But those are the 6 businesses. So what's my mission? I want to value each of these businesses separately. Let's start easy. If I ask you to price United Technologies, and I gave you 5 minutes to do it, you can't dig deep, right? So what's the easiest way for me to price it? take some number like EBITDA, look up the EV to EBITDA of companies in each sector, and that's what I did. This is my first level pricing, very fundamental pricing. So those are the EV to EBITDAs for other companies in each of these businesses. I multiply the EBITDA by the EV to EBITDA. I come up with an enterprise value by business. I add them all up and say, I'm done. Value of United Technologies, really the price of United Technologies, the sum of its parts, is about $61.7 billion. Critique me. What's wrong with doing this? Because this is what most analysts do when they talk about sum of the parts valuation, is pick one common variable, find a multiple of that variable, apply the multiple and do it. Okay, so first is we don't know whether EV to EBITDA is going to be the best multiple for all six sectors. What else? Second is, what happens to all that G&A cost? Where did it go? I've kind of ignored it because it's not in any business. So I'm saying it's not, and it's a negative number. That freaks me out even more. So I just throw it away. Second problem. What's the third one?
Intercompany interactions.
Intercompany, and also, are all these companies in each business just like Otis or Carrier? I mean, we've talked about differences across companies and growth and risk, and we're not capturing any of that stuff either. So let's at least fix some of the problems. So here's what I did as my first try. I said, you know what? Why EV to EBITDA for all six companies? Why can't I pick the best multiple within each sector? So here's what I did. I took each sector and I ran regressions on four or five multiples. I picked the one which had the highest R squared, and basically it was EV to EBITDA for refrigeration, EV to revenues for defense, EV to capital for security. So basically I got three different multiples play out. They're all EV multiples because it is a little messy. If you do some equity multiples and some enterprise value multiples, it's not impossible, but it is messy. So I picked the best multiple. And then I control for the variables that were causing the multiple to be different. So it's almost like a multiple, what I did with individual companies and sectors, I'm doing this for each business. I came up with a predicted value based on those regressions. So basically I'm plugging in the numbers using United Technologies numbers for each of those variables. I come up with predicted values, I add them all up. I get a value for the entire company without the overhead still, which is kind of hanging out there, of $74.23 billion. So it was $61.7 billion with just the basic EV to EBITDA for everything. Now that I've adjusted for differences and used different multiples, I come up with $74 billion. But they're both pricing attempts, not valuation attempts. Could I do an intrinsic valuation of each business? What do I need to do for an intrinsic valuation? What are the inputs I need? I need cash flows, I need growth, and I need a cost of capital by business, right? Let's start with the easy one there. How do I get a cost of capital for each business? I go find the unlevered betas of other companies in the business, I adjust for the debt ratio, so that's going to be easy. For growth, I need a return on invested capital and a reinvestment rate. If I have that for each business, maybe I can use that for the growth rate. So let's try to do an intrinsic valuation of each business. So first thing I did was I computed a cost of capital by business, which reflects an unlevered beta by looking at the business. I did apply United Technologies' debt-to-equity ratio for all six of them because United Technologies doesn't tell me where it parks its debt. I considered actually putting more debt in some of them, but all of these are pretty capital-intensive businesses, so I wasn't going to waste my time too much finessing this. I got a levered beta by business. That gives me a cost of equity. I did apply United Technologies' cost of debt, again, because it's borrowing money for all these businesses. And in the last column, you see a cost of capital by business ranging from 7.72% for Pratt & Whitney to 6.78% for Fire & Security to 9.82% for Sikorsky. So I've got a cost of capital. To get the growth rate, here's what I did. I computed the return on capital for each of these businesses because they gave me information on the operating income. And I divided by the invested capital in each of these businesses. I had to make some judgment calls about, you know, where to put, because they gave me total assets, they didn't give me invested capital, but I kind of made the proportionate adjustment. So there are my returns on capital by business. Otis, the return on capital is almost 36%. Fire and Security, the return on capital is about 6%. The reinvestment rate is computed based on the capex that they gave me for each business. So there's my reinvestment rate. Huge reinvestment rate in the aircraft business, very low in the elevator business. My expected growth is going to be that return on capital times the reinvestment rate. So here's what my final numbers are going to look like. There's my cost of capital. my return on capital from the previous page and the reinvestment rate, the expected growth that I'm going to attach to each business, at least for the near term. Beyond 5 years, I'm going to put them into stable growth. And one business I've already put into stable growth because the growth rate was low enough. And my stable growth rate when I did this was when risk-free rates were 3.something%. There's my growth rate in perpetuity and a stable return on capital, set equal to the cost of capital. So it's almost like I'm doing six different DCF valuations on the six businesses. So here's what my sum of my intrinsic valuations of the six businesses were. So I'm plugging into a DCF valuation. The sum of the DCF valuations is 80.25%. I'm very close to the end here. There's that one item which I haven't dealt with, which is corporate overhead. Corporate overhead, of course, is an outflow, right? It's going to service the entire company. So here's how I dealt with corporate overhead. I took the overhead, which is a negative number. I get a tax benefit because that corporate overhead is tax deductible. I treated it as a growing perpetuity, growing at the same rate as the economy. And I applied the company's overall cost of capital to it. And I came up with the present value of corporate overheads in perpetuity of $4.6 billion. Present values are additive, right? So basically, I can net them out. The value that I get, 80.25 minus 4.6 billion, is my intrinsic valuation for United Technologies as a sum of the parts. Just to give you a contrast, the value that I got from the relative valuation of the pricing was 74.2, but I should be netting out the same 4,587 from that as well, so it's closer to 70 billion. And if I did, I actually did a full company DCF. You know what I mean by a full company DCF? I took the entire operating income, the entire reinvestment, which is what we tend to do with these big companies, and I got $71 billion. And all of those numbers were greater than the market price when I did this. It was, I think, 2010, 2011. So basically, sum of the parts valuation is just expanding my job because I now have to do this on six businesses. Yeah.
A couple of questions. Aren't you
Yeah, that's a pricing of the company. So I have a value for the company. It's cheap on an intrinsic value basis. It's cheap on a price basis.
But what I'm saying is when you subtract the corporate overhead from the sum of parts.
No, because that's not a pricing, though. That's actually a valuation, right? None of this, every part of this is an intrinsic value, right? It's discounted cash flow valuation. The overhead is a discounted cash flow value as well.
Right.
Oh, you're saying if I net the 4,587 from this, you could apply a multiple.
You could do a weighted average.
Just do a the EV to EBITDA multiple on the 454 million, say 8 times that. There's no reason why it won't work at least as well as it worked on the rest of it. So if you want to stay true to it all being pricing, you might say I'm going to apply a multiple to the overhead to come up with an estimated price for the overhead. No,
and
come
up.
Because when you do company DCFs, you are kind of aggregating these businesses. And I'll tell you one place where it's going to show up. Remember I put different growth rates for the different businesses? The way that should show up in an individual company valuation is my unlevered beta for the company actually should be different in year 2, year 3, year 4, year 5 because my business mix is changing. I wasn't doing that. And that's one of the things we often do with multi-business companies. When we value them as an combined company, as one company, is we're ignoring the fact that China might be growing much faster than the US, that manufacturing might be growing much less than the services part, and that we're not capturing that enough in a combined.
So you prefer the sum of the parts?
I almost never do sum of the parts, and here's why. United Technologies, I had the data that I could do this. I've tried this on Sony. You get so frustrated at so many different levels, partly because of intercompany transactions, and partly because the accounting is completely opaque. That at some point you say, I give up. So the reason we don't do sum of the parts valuation actually is not because we don't know how to do it, but because the information we're given by most companies is insufficient for us to actually do a sum of the parts valuation. Okay. Any other questions? I actually bought United Technologies. I'd have to go back and look at what date that was based on the sum of the parts valuation. It's actually if you were more interested in this section, I have a, it's a chapter in one of my books. It's also a paper on my website. I actually rip off my own books, and you'll see whole sections of it show up as a paper you can download. It's called, I think, Valuing the Octopus, because that's what multi-business companies have, tentacles in different countries and different businesses. So you got to learn to deal with all the tentacles and kind of go through the process of why you might pick one over the other. But this can be nightmarish in companies where everything is connected to everything else, where you can't do that separation easily. You'll be double counting, miscounting, doing all kinds of strange things if you're not careful. And I'll tell you one other thing that troubles me about these activist investors who target multi-business companies is they often act like this entire $408 million is a wasteful expenditure. You ask them, what about that corporate headquarters? Oh, we'll get rid of the whole thing. That's a pretty cynical view of entire corporate headquarters. The accountants are there. You don't need accountants. What about your marketing people? They might all be there. So I think that there's a lot of laziness on the part of activist investors as well. This morning in my corporate finance class, I took Walgreens, which has been targeted by activist investors as a company that can borrow more money. And actually, we're doing optimal debt ratios in corporate finance. So I said, hey, you know, they think Walgreens is underlevered. Let's see if it is. Walgreens' actual debt ratio is 30.5%. Its optimal debt ratio is 30%. So where's this extra debt capacity that you see? Then we turned off the lease option, and it looks underlevered. If you ignore leases at Walgreens, it doesn't have enough debt, but that's incredibly stupid. If that's the reason you're asking Walgreens to borrow, that's like borrowing a ton of money and buying J. Crew, right? Which actually happened. And I was shocked when I saw this, because it was Mickey Drexler and a group of private equity investors, and they said, J. Crew has no debt. And it didn't in traditional terms. You looked at the balance sheet. We can borrow a ton of money. No, you can't. Because you borrow the money, and then you're going to wake up tomorrow with that debt and the lease commitments to meet. So it might not have anything to do with activist investors somehow having inside information. It just might be that they screwed up on a very basic concept that allows them to then target these companies and say, you should borrow more money. Okay. So any questions on asset-based valuation? Yes. The words come up all the time, right? Some of the parts, anybody can throw it into the discussion. Is there an actual valuation to back up the words? Most of the time, the answer is no. Which is, they just have a sense. They're idiot savants who can gauge some of the parts' valuations, maybe. But most of the time, there is nothing that backs up those words other than, it worked the last time I tried it on this other company. If you want to do it right, do intrinsic valuation. In fact, I think I did my eBay and PayPal, 5 months ago on my blog, where I took the two and I tried to value them as separate entities. Yeah? Okay. It's not difficult. eBay and PayPal are actually very easy to separate at the hip and value as separate entities. Yeah? So now let's talk about private company valuation. The process by which you value private companies is no different than the process by which you value public companies. So let's set that on the table first, right? You take the cash flows, you discount them back at a discount rate, you get a value. If you take cash flows to equity, you discount at the cost of equity. Cash flows to the firm, you discount at the cost of capital. But there are two fundamental issues you're going to run into, and we'll talk about why these are a problem. You don't realize how much you are dependent on having a market price for your company when you do valuation until you don't have it. You know why you're dependent? The minute you finish evaluation, to get a sense of whether you're on the right track, what did you check it against? You check the market price. It's nice to have a number out there. You might tell me the market is wrong, but it's nice to have a number out there saying, am I within shouting distance? And if you think about all the inputs into discounted cash flow valuation, think of how many depended on a market price being available. Cost of capital. What are the weights we attach to debt and equity? Market value for equity, market value for debt. So one of the first things you're going to notice when I yank away the market price, you can say, oh my God, what do I do now? So you've got to deal with that. The second is, I mean, you get used to some strange things happening with public company financial statements. You work with private company financial statements, get used to a whole new, it's almost like entering into a new galaxy of strange things happening. So I'm going to talk about the three basic issues. You're going to run into the private company valuation. Let's see if we can get over them. First is, we don't have a market value, and that's a problem because we use market value for inputs. If you're, the way you get betas is by running a regression, which we don't, but if you did, you can't get a regression beta for a private company, and you cannot use market values to compute the weights of debt and equity, so you're stuck on the cost of capital. And as I said, once you're finished with the valuation, you often check it against the market value to see if, in fact, you're within shouting distance of the number. So first thing to remember with private companies, you're not going to have a market value. It also becomes an issue when private companies grant options. Do you see why it becomes an issue? Because when public companies grant options, we price the options by looking at the market price. We put in Black-Scholes, we use the standard deviation, we can use all kinds of neat stuff, and all of that becomes more difficult with a private company. Second, we talked about cash flows, right? We get our cash flows from income statements and balance sheets and statements of cash flows for private companies just as much as public companies. But most of the time, private businesses don't have the kind of history that public companies do. That I'm not a big, I don't have a big deal on, because let's face it, if you're valuing GoPro, you don't have a whole lot of history either. But the history tends to be compressed. Second, the accounting standards do tend to vary a lot more across private businesses. I remember somebody in a valuation class from about 7 or 8 years ago who wanted to value her mother's flower business as part of this class. And I said, hey, go ahead. So she comes in about halfway through the class in a complete panic. She said, I can't do this. And I said, why not? She said, I talked to my mother about getting the numbers, and she has the Post-it accounting system. And I said, what is that? She says there's a whole room where she covers the wall with Post-it notes. So she has blue notes for revenues and red notes for costs. She, every time she has a cost, she pulls. And at the end of the year, she pulls all the Post-it notes down and prepares her financial statements. I guess that's as good as any other, but that's not uncommon, especially if you go to small private businesses. The accounting can become a very, it can be much more difficult to get your hands around. Third, this happens in public companies as well, so I shouldn't pick on private business, but the line between the business and the personal in a private company is a very gray one, right? The company car magically disappears around 4:15 every evening. Why? Because there is to pick up the kids from school. Nobody keeps accounting of that. There are an awful lot of people around the business. So who, what does that person do? I don't know. He's the nephew of the owner, the niece of the owner, the uncle of the owner. I mean, you have all these people who are populating the company who are getting salaries, I get, but no, just passing off profits. And I call this the George Costanza effect. I mean, all those years of watching Seinfeld, I never figured out what George did for the Yankees. He was, what, assistant equipment manager for the Yankees or something like that? I think the only episode where he actually did something was when he replaced the uniforms with polyester or something, and it caused rashes to break out or something like that. Most of the time he's talking the back of George Steinbrenner's head. But I never figured out what he did. And there are a lot of George Costanzas in private businesses. No idea what they do. They show up every day. They get paid. No, what do they do? And finally, and this is a big issue in private company valuation. You know, watch Shark Tank, where one of the questions people ask the person pitching an idea is, how much money did your business make last year? And there's 100,000, 150,000. We blew up, I mean, there was, like last week, we're watching this, the two ladies who blow up balloons that they can send through the, and they've got their six-year-old that they pay $3 an hour for. It's like slave labor with all the kids working in it. So what did you make last year? 100,000. Sounds profitable, right? But then one of the sharks asked a key question. Do you pay yourself a salary? No. You think, so what? These people spend 35, 40 hours a week in their garages, and there are three people involved. And you think about what they would have to pay somebody to do this if it were an outsider. There goes $100,000. And a lot of private businesses, that's something to remember, because if you're the owner of a private business, you don't care to charge yourself a salary because the money's going to come to you anyway. What difference does it make whether you pay it as a salary or you take it out as a dividend? So you've got to kind of almost redo the financials to reflect that salary you'd have to pay to that owner if that owner were to count the hours he or she spends. So here's the key point, remember, about private company valuations. If somebody asks you to value a private company, before you take on the mission, ask them why they want to value. They'll think you're incredibly nosy, but here's the reason you need it. The value you arrive at for the company will depend on the motive for the valuations. What motives could there be for a valuation? It could be just what I call show valuations. You know what show valuations are? Either the owner is just curious, wants to find out what his or her business is worth, or it's for show, for courts, for divorce, for whatever it is. This is what my business... So show valuations have no money behind them, so you can hire expert witnesses, you can come up with a number. So it could be show valuations. It could be transaction valuation. We have to sell to somebody, but then you have to ask a follow-up question. To whom? Are you selling to another individual? And we talked a little bit about why this is going to matter. Are you going to sell to a company? Are you going to sell to a private equity investor? Are you going to sell to... Who are you selling it to? It could be as a prelude to setting a price for an initial public offering. A social media company. So those could all be potential motives. If you're valuing the division of a company... It could be as a prelude to a spin-off. GE calls you and says, give us a number for GE Capital. We're planning to spin it off for sale to another entity that wants to buy this division from them, as Ford did when they sold Land Rover Jaguar to Tata Motors. Or because you want to do a sum of the parts valuation by adding up the divisions. How you approach the valuation will depend on which of these motives drives the valuation. And with private company valuations, broadly speaking, there are four different kinds of private company valuations you might have to do. One is what I call private-to-private transaction. One private owner selling to another private owner. One doctor selling to another doctor. Those are the trickiest valuations to do because you've got an undiversified seller selling to an undiversified buyer. Somebody's going to have their entire wealth tied up in the business. There are all kinds of issues. We'll talk about all the issues. Then I'm going to talk about private-to-public, and these are easy. You know why? Because once this private business gets sold into a public company, it becomes part of the public company, you don't have to worry about liquidity and diversification, all the, so you can value it like any other public business because it's a private to public transaction. You can have a private to IPO. Again, very similar to valuing any other public company because after the valuation, it's going to become part of a public marketplace. We'll talk about a couple of issues specific to IPOs which might have to be brought into the valuation. And finally, you could have a private company that's approaching a venture capitalist as a transition because they want the capital to eventually become public companies. We want to talk about private to VC to public, and that can create an intermediate period where you're moving from one kind of investor to another. So let's start with private to private transactions and talk about the three basic problems you're going to face. First is, yeah, it's Joseph. It's VC. I would say so. Basically, it's an intermediate step. You go to the PE firm. The PE firm wants to bundle you up and either take you public or sell you to somebody public, right? So VC, to me, PE firms, when they enter in here, are entering into the old VC territory, right? So basically, let's talk about private-to-private transaction. Neither the buyer nor the seller is diversified, so we're going to bring that in. Second, here's where liquidity is at its peak, right? You have two people who've tied up their entire wealth in the business. They care a lot about liquidity. And third, and this is, I think, especially in the context of medical and dental practices, is what's called a key person discount. Let me explain. You decide to buy a dental practice from a dentist who's been around 35 years in a town. Everybody in the town goes to that dentist to get their teeth cleaned, teeth pulled, etc. You look at his books, he's making a lot of money. He has a lot of patients. You buy the business based on the money he made and the patients he has, and he goes off to Florida. Next day, you ensconce yourself in his office. The patients start coming in. They sit in the dentist chair. The dental technician cleans their teeth, and then you show up. The person says, "Who the hell are you?" "I'm your new dentist. Get away from me. I'm leaving." Basically, that business you see there is connected to that person. And with medical practices, dental practices, plumbing practices, anything which has a personal component, if you're buying a business, you've got to factor in that what you see might not be what you get because those people might not stay on with you. We'll talk about strategies you can adopt as a seller of the business to try to alleviate this problem. It's called the key person discount. So we're going to talk about diversification, we're going to talk about illiquidity, we're going to talk about key person. So let me at least set the table because we're getting pretty close to the end. Let's assume that you have been asked to value an upscale French restaurant. By the chef who plans to sell the restaurant and move back to France. Both the restaurant is doing well, business has been good, so you're looking at a good business. The potential buyer is a former investment banker who's always wanted to own a restaurant but doesn't know how to cook. He just wants the glamour of having an upscale restaurant. He's going to take his entire savings, and this is going to be key, and put it into the restaurant. You have access to the financial statements of the restaurant. The chef has given it to you. And the chef reported $400,000 in pre-tax operating profit last year. Right? But he didn't charge himself a salary. So file that away because you're saying that's got to be played in somewhere. The firm has no conventional debt. It has a lease commitment for $120,000 each year for the next 12 years. So your job, and this is what we're going to do when we start on Monday, is to value the restaurant, which means you've got to take the financials and convert them into cash flows. You've got to adjust for the fact that you've got your entire wealth invested now in this restaurant. You've got to factor that into your cost of equity and cost of capital. You've got to value the restaurant and then say, well, how much should I knock off from the value because I've now become completely illiquid, right? I can't get out of this business quickly. How much do I knock it off? And how do I bring in the fact that this restaurant, remember restaurants and chefs are connected at the hip, so people go to a restaurant because of the chef. That guy leaves. Is this restaurant even going to attract customers? Is there a key person discount I should be attaching? It'll allow us to bring all those issues into play. So we'll start with that on Monday, is actually take the restaurant through the process of attaching a number and perhaps get into IPOs. So I'll see you on Monday.
Thank you.
think of that as a philosophical foundation. So your support to reprice that, that's what impairment is. So it's a massively impacted acquisition being repriced. It's a reprice. If you buy a social media company with debt, and the price of a social media company is not, then you have to reprice your social media.
But isn't it based on like the assets cash flow? So you that's what I'm saying.
That's why it's so frustrating. Because accountants are told one thing in the mission statement, but the kind of backing that they have to provide the number is all in the So which is you can reverse engineer into whatever
right,
you
right,
want.
Right, right, exactly.
But if you look at impairments, they're driven by price, which is you buy a target company in second and cost price 50%. You're going to impair it 50%, but now you've got to do an intrinsic valuation of why it happened when it happened.